Wow. It's good to see you again. I was sharing with Martin before we came here tonight that this was the first room I shared my near-death experience in a public setting. And Robert Little was the person who invited me to come, and I was scared to death. And I still get a little bit nervous, even with all the speaking I've done to stand up and open my heart, I guess. The near-death experience is something that sticks with you. It's actually been 26 years since I had my experience, but it's like it's yesterday. I'm still waiting to have the capacity to share the experience without getting emotional about it. So bear with me. I grew up here in Utah. This is home to me. In fact, I came down from Heber City this morning and stopped at the airport and then met the board. And there's nothing like being home. I fed the horses and grabbed a jacket and came to speak at Ions. When I tell people around the world when I speak that I'm from Utah, it's people have different perceptions. They have different takes on Utah, whether they've heard of it or not. And just never be ashamed of where you come from. It's your DNA. It's in your bones. It's in your bones. And I live up in Wasatch County where I grew up, but as I look at the mountains and look at what I call the front side of Tim, many would say it's the back side of Tim. It's in my bones. It's in my DNA. And so is this. So is here being home. I never intended to share the near-death experience. I never intended to write a book about it. I never intended to speak publicly about it. In fact, I was quite guarded. Oh, you want me to put this on?
That's marked.
Okay, is that better?
Yeah,
Is
you
that
just put it
enough?
in your pocket.
All right, I'll put it in my pocket. I usually have rocks and sticks and all kinds of stuff in my pockets. I'm a stone collector. I'll see a little rock and think, oh, I want to take that one home with me and put it in my pocket. So the near-death experience, I never intended to speak about it or write about it or anything. I held it very tight, very closely. It was very private. It was very personal. In some ways, it was very painful. And I didn't speak about it publicly for about almost a decade. I didn't write a book about it for 11 years after the accident had happened. But as I said earlier, it's as if it was yesterday. I don't remember the details in the hospital. I don't remember all that information, but the near-death experience is something that is fresh always. It was March 31st of 1997, and we've been in southern Utah celebrating Easter. It's the Easter holiday. We'd gone down to visit extended family. We had done all the family traditions. We had hard-boiled eggs and then colored the eggs brilliant colors and hid them in the garden for the kids to go look at and find. It was me and my wife and our two boys. And let me just give some context to that. I met my wife when I was a young man. I was like 21 years old. I was a young college student up in Logan at Utah State. I was playing football up there. And she walked in the room and I didn't even know her name. But I knew. Wow. It wasn't just love at first sight. And yes, she was gorgeous, but I knew. It was like a lightning bolt hit me and said, there she is. And probably the biggest miracle is that I introduced myself, that I actually talked to her because, believe it or not, I was very shy. And that turned into a friendship and a courtship and a marriage. And at the time of the accident, we'd been married for 10 years. We were just getting ready to celebrate our 10-year wedding anniversary. We'd had two sons. Spencer, my oldest, came into the family about 3 years into our marriage, and he was such a joy. He and his wife just made me a grandfather 2 weeks ago, so that's cool. Got a little grandson. And then our second child, Griffin, came 6 years after that. And we had some challenges getting Griffin here. There had been complications in the first pregnancy. There was all kinds of things going on. He was our miracle boy. The doctors had said, you may not ever have any more children, but he was our miracle boy. He came. And that's the group. Me, my wife, and our two boys were there for Easter weekend. We'd had a beautiful weekend. It's interesting in hindsight what sticks not only in your mind, but in your heart. Griffin at the time was just a toddler. He was just 14 months old. And he was just learning to walk and just saying a few words. And I'll never forget watching him as he would pull himself up. He'd take a few steps, he'd fall down, he'd go find the colored eggs, and then he'd bring them to me. And he'd hold them up. And the only words he would really say is, "Dad, ball." He thought it was a ball. And Spencer, on the other hand, was all about the Easter baskets. I had climbed up in a tree and hung Easter baskets in the tree. I wanted to make it a challenge, so he had to climb the tree to get the baskets, and that's what he was all about. But we'd had a wonderful weekend, and we, finished that. It was Monday morning. It was time to get back to work. I had taken Monday off, and stop, wait. I thought she'd forgotten something in the house. I put the car in park. And she looked at me and she said, "I just want to say goodbye to mom and dad one more time." Now, at the time, I thought, women, we packed the car, we're ready to go, I'm pulling away. But I noticed as she got out of the car and she ran up to the porch, and there was grandma and grandpa, waving like they do. And she not only hugged them, but she kissed them both. I watched as she hugged them and kissed them, and I noticed that. I noticed that. Now, in hindsight, I realize how crucial that was. I don't know what it was like to be her, but something said, "Stop. Go say goodbye to mom and dad one more time." And she heard the whisper and she did it. How powerful life can be when we hear the whisper. And then we do it. We take action. And she did that. And she kissed mom and dad and hugged them. And then she joyfully ran back to the car and buckled in. And I headed for the interstate. I cranked the cruise control up to 75 miles an hour. And away we went up the road. But based on the events of that day, that was the last goodbye. Now, as we drove, I was thinking about all the things I had to do, all the things at work, what I was missing, how I was behind. I was 33 years old and running my own advertising agency. How many dads have we got out there? Just raise your hands. Hi. This culture we live in. Got to be the man, got to make it happen, got to provide, got to get the grade, make the team, get the job, get the girl, buy the house, get the car. That's what was going on in my head. All the things I had to do and the pressures of those 12, 14, 16-hour days. As I was thinking about that, I just happened to look in the rearview mirror, just glance. It was a moment. It was a moment. It was a glance in the rearview mirror just to see where traffic was. But as I glanced, I noticed Griffin in the car seat and he had fallen sound asleep. And I thought, wow, look at him. That's the miracle boy. Now, this was just a moment. This was literally a glance, but it's like time stopped. And there was that miracle boy. And I thought, wow, look at him. I noticed details. I noticed how long his eyelashes were. I noticed how his hand sat on the little, you know, tray on the car seat. I even thought that boy, we gotta trim his fingernails when we get home. And then I heard Spencer behind me playing with these action figures he'd gotten in his Easter basket and making all the joyful noise of a little boy. And then I glanced over at Tamara, who had also reclined her seat, and she was sound asleep, but she was still holding on to my hand. I was driving with this one, and she was holding on to this one. And there was this absolute moment of gratitude. I thought, wow, we're 10 years into this thing, and she's still holding my hand. She's still holding on to my hand, like when I had a couple of kids in college and took her to a dollar movie. That's all I could afford. But in this absolute moment of gratitude, I'll never forget that. It was about an hour after that that everything came apart. There was reports of crosswinds. There was reports of a red pickup truck that was driving erratically on the interstate. Maybe the hardest part of this story is I believe what may have happened is I think I dozed off at the wheel. Those 12, 14, 16-hour days. I mean, not that I fell asleep, but just nodded off. And I remember swerving to the right and then overcorrecting to the left. And as I overcorrected, I lost control of the car, and then the car began to roll. Not off the road, but down the road at 75 miles an hour. It was a high-speed single car rollover. I blacked out for most of that, but when the car came to a stop, I was completely conscious. And the first thing I heard was Spencer, my 7-year-old, crying hysterically in the back seat. And I thought, I got to get to my boy. I've got to get to my boy. But that's when I realized I couldn't move. I was pinned either to the floorboard or the seat. I couldn't tell. There was the rancid smell of gasoline. There was all the broken glass. And I was unaware of my injuries. I knew I was in pain. I knew I was struggling to breathe, but I was unaware of what had happened. Actually, both of my legs had been crushed. And my left leg was eventually amputated above the knee. My back had been damaged. My rib cage had been damaged. My lungs were collapsing. My right arm had almost been torn off. And then the seatbelt had cut through and ruptured all my intestines. I had no idea. All I knew is my boy's crying. I got to get to him. But that's when I realized that no one else was crying. I knew there at the scene, and I saw. I won't get into what I knew and saw, but I knew that both my wife Tamara and my son Griffin were gone. They were killed instantly in this rollover. And I share that because that is one of the darkest moments I've ever been in. Got a hysterical child in the back seat. I'm pinned, I'm losing consciousness. Half the family's gone and I was driving a car. You know, the guilt, the regret, I kept, you know, I work a lot of on a computer, and there's this little control Z thing that you can undo. You can undo. I kept thinking, can I undo this? I need those 3 seconds back. And it was in that darkness and that despair that the near-death experience began to unfold. Contrast. As I was there losing consciousness in that darkness, suddenly light came. Light came. It literally came to me. Tangible light came and surrounded me. It felt like it was comforting me in all this despair. I began to rise above the accident scene, or there was a lift. It felt like I was rising above or being delivered out of it. And suddenly I could breathe and there was no pain. And I was literally thinking, how can I possibly be okay? What's happened? And it was, I became somewhat grounded in this light, around me. Suddenly Tamara, my wife, who I knew was deceased at the scene, suddenly she's there in the light with me. But she was emphatic. She She kept saying, "Jeff, you can't stay. You can't stay. You got to go. You got to go. You can't come. You got to go back." And we literally had this conversation about if I stayed with her, Spencer would be orphaned. Couldn't do that. And Griffin, my little toddler son, was not in this scenario. It was just she and I talking. But she was emphatic. I return. I go back. We had the conversation. I made the choice. We made a deal. I said, "I'll go back. I'll go back." Now, what I believe happened is my spirit left my body. Her spirit already left her body. We were in some type of a realm of a holding tank of light. We were able to have this conversation. Some of my good friends laugh and tell me, "Well, your own wife kicked you out of heaven, you know, and that may be the case, I suppose." But we made a choice, and I made a choice to come back. Now, I didn't have to think about how do I get back. Just consciousness, intention. I'm going back. And then I found myself moving about, wandering about a very busy level one trauma center ER setting. I have no concept of time in this bubble of light, this goodbye. I later found out people arrived at the scene. You know, Spencer was banged up, but he basically walked away from the accident. With my injuries, I had to be extricated from the car and then airlifted or life flighted to the closest level one trauma center, which happened to be right here in Salt Lake City. I didn't know any of that. I knew I'd crashed the car. I knew half the family was gone. I knew Tamara was very much alive and well, and I'd had this profound goodbye. And then here I was wandering around the hospital, seeing the doctors, the patients, the nurses, the families of the patients. It's almost like I had this extreme awareness of everything that was going on. And everyone I saw, I knew them. I knew them not by visual recognition, but I felt them. There was a oneness. That's what I call it. Now, there was a oneness. I was them. They were me. I mean, quick example, a nurse passed me in the hallway, completely unaware of me. Of course, it's my spirit wandering about. In that instant, I felt her life, almost as if it was my own. I felt the abuse that she had survived as a child, the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. I felt it as if it was my own. And yet, in that same instant, I saw her magnificence. I'm like, wow, look at her healing, serving, helping in the hospital. And everyone I saw, it was that. I knew everything about them. I was connected to them. And yet I saw their magnificence. I felt this divinity around them and about them. I grew up in a conservative Christian home. Even a biblical verse came up. It was the famous verse, "In as much as you've done it unto the least of one of these, you've done it unto me." And I used to believe that was a nice verse about being nice. What I was experiencing is an absolute connection where I realized, wow, when Jesus said that, he was saying, "I am the man in prison. I am the beggar in the street. I am the stranger that just longs to be accepted. I am you, and you are me, and we're connected. We're one." I was having this profound experience as I wandered until I finally came up to a body or a man laying on the gurney that I didn't feel anything from, which I thought was odd given this connected thing that was happening. So I stepped closer and looked. And that's when I realized that was me. But it wasn't me. I mean, I was having this profound experience, but there was my body. There was my flesh. There was the tabernacle, if you will. And it was a mess. It was a wreck. I remember this sadness, but also this reverence as I looked at my body. The sadness and the broken state it was, and this reverence that I never realized. I had taken it for granted. You know, gosh, I'd been a Division I athlete, and I never even fathomed that I didn't have to remind my lungs to breathe. I didn't have to think about my heart beating. I didn't have to tell my eyes how to see or my feet how to move. The body was this miraculous machine, this miracle, this beautiful gift. And Ed, I knew I had to get back in, and mine was busted. I mean, it was busted. Now, there's something unique about my near-death experience because as I entered back in the body, and that was heavy, back to the guilt, the grief, the regret, the trauma. But the medical team also had a profound experience. In fact, Dr. Jeff O'Driscoll's here tonight. He came with me. He's become one of my dear friends. He was the one of the attending physicians in this level one trauma center. And as the team was working on me, Jeff O'Driscoll experienced, the doc, he experienced that my wife's spirit was in that operating room. In fact, he saw her standing above me, floating above me, above my gurney. And she communicated with him. And when I asked him what she was communicating, we later talked about this. He said she simply shared her gratitude for all we are doing to save your life. He didn't know I'd made that deal. He didn't know I'd had a near-death experience. We became dear friends as we shared and opened up with each other. But it's interesting that clinicians, you know, accredited doctors and a nurse had this profound experience where they saw and felt and experienced something at the same time I was coming back into the body, perhaps. I was saying goodbye to Tamara, and Dr. O'Driscoll was saying hello in a very profound way where all those rounds just fold into one. Magic now, I suppose. I was in the hospital for 5 months plus. I had 18 surgeries in total. I had horrible infections. I would throw pulmonary emboli, the blood clots that lodge in your lungs. I was in ICU to surgical recovery, back to ICU. And it was a long, I learned a lot. I learned a lot. I learned the meaning of be still. I had no choice. There was a ventilator down my throat doing the breathing for my lungs. My legs were immobile. My right arm was immobile. They eventually tied down my left arm and hand because I kept grabbing at all the medical equipment. But yeah, to be still. To be still and to contemplate all that had happened. Not only the out of body, but the death of half the family and the regret that I was driving the car. I would feel things in the hospital. I would feel the energy of people as the nurses would come in or the doctors would come in. I could feel where they were energetically. I had profound experiences in the hospital, the most profound. Was at the end of my hospital stay. I had been there. I was out of ICU. I was out of surgical recovery. I was actually in the rehabilitation room at the hospital. And I was grieving as miserably as any man grieves, even with the experience I had had. And particularly about my little boy. You know, I had said goodbye to Tamara. She had been there in that light. I had also had dreams and visions of her during that hospital stay, but my little boy at the accident, he was thrown from the car, and I just knew he was gone. But I lamented that and I grieved that. And as I was at the end of my hospital stay, I was in this rehabilitation wing and they had finally, you know, stabilized my abdominal injuries and put a colostomy on for my intestines so I could roll on my side and sleep without spilling my guts out, right? And I remember finally laying on my side, which is the way I naturally sleep, and it felt so good to finally do that. I had laid on my back so long, I'd rubbed all the hair off the back of my head. The back of my head was bald because I'd laid there so long in the hospital bed. But in this peaceful sleep, sleeping on my side, I felt that light come again, that tangible, comforting light in my grief that seemed to be warming me and holding me, and it felt as if I rose above the hospital bed. This was the same thing, just like at the accident. I was like, wow. Now, how many have had loved ones pass? Almost everyone. Sometimes people are concerned about what was that like? I mean, you could probably fathom that I died kind of a violent death in the crash and everything, but I'll tell you what, the light and the leaving of the body, it's one of the most beautiful things, the most natural things. And here I was again, out of the body, in this light, but this time the light dispensed, it went away. And I was in the most beautiful place. You know, people have said to me, well, what was it like? And I suppose the near-death experience is as unique as our life experiences are. But for me, it was this beautiful meadow and the grass was just about waist high. And I could feel the life and the beauty and the love in every single thing, including me. It was such a physical experience. I realized, yes, I was out of the physical body, but I could feel the energy of the ground beneath my feet. I could feel the intelligence in my calves and thighs, and I had both legs. I was whole. In fact, I was so joyful. You know, people say heaven, the other side, the spirit world. The only word that comes close to what I was experiencing is I was home. I was home. And I began to run with healthy legs and thinking, wow, I'm here. And then I had the knowing that I wasn't there to stay. And at that same time, there was this strange corridor off to my left. And I knew intuitively I'm to go down that way. And I did. I began to work my way down the corridor. And at the end of the corridor was a crib. And Griffin, a toddler, he was still sleeping in a crib when the accident happened. And so I raced down this corridor to the crib. And I looked in the crib, and there he was. There he was, sleeping as beautifully as when I'd looked in the rearview mirror. And I noticed the same things. I noticed how long his eyelashes were. Huh? And I swept him up in my arms, you know, I held him. And I began to weep, thinking, wow, have you ever picked up a sleeping child? There's a weight and a heat about it. And I held him against me, and he was solid. And I was thinking, how can this be? How is this so physical? But I even leaned over and I smelled his hair. And I don't know if you've smelled the hair of a loved one or of a child, but it's like, it's him. This is my boy. And I began weeping and I was holding him. And then there was this intense presence behind me, this overwhelming, powerful, cosmic, wise presence. And it was coming closer and closer. And the guilt began to come up. I thought, wow, that's God. That's what I call it. That's God. And my little boy's here because I crashed the car. You know, his life was cut short because somehow I overcorrected or dozed off or whatever happened. And this presence is coming closer and closer. And I'm feeling all the guilt bubble up and thinking it's my fault. And as the presence came closer and closer and I'm weeping, holding my little boy, I had this thought. And the thought was, I hope I can be forgiven. And that's when the whole lid came off. And this felt physical too. This presence came so close and these divine arms just wrapped around me and my little boy. And then there was just a download of love and peace and beauty and connection and wholeness. I saw my life. You know, they say you have the life review. I didn't know what it was at that point, but I saw my life. I saw my parents' divorce. I saw the insecurities it caused in me. I saw the bandages I put on that by being an athlete, by, making the team, getting the grade, getting the girl, getting the car, getting the house, all these things to cover up the insecure little boy. And I saw things and I thought, well, that was a mistake. I didn't mean to do that. And this divine, beloved being, God, if you will, that held me, said, there's no mistakes. What did you learn? What did you learn? And I saw things and I thought, well, I knew that was wrong and I did it anyway. And the being that held me communicated, that's your judgment of it, not ours. You're as beloved and precious and perfect as the little boy you hold. And there I was, looking at my little boy who was perfect to me. And I felt this overwhelming love. It was a very personal experience, but I knew it not only was relevant for me, it was for every living soul. In fact, I felt that the immenseness, the universe, if you will, this overwhelming, big cosmic thing. And yet here it was about me and my little life and what was happening. I had another download in that moment because, and it was strange, I don't often share this, I've become more open about it, but God said, I want you to exercise your will. And I'm like, my will? I thought it was your will. I've been taught that since I was a little boy. It's your will. This was your will. And what was communicated to me is, my will is your will. That's how much you're loved. My will has always been that you have free will, that you get to choose. And so you can be mad at God all your life because the accident was allowed to happen. Or you can beat yourself up for the rest of your life because you were driving the car. But in this perfect moment, you can choose to give your son back. You can trust and hand him over and exercise your will in the situation so it doesn't feel like he's been drug away from you, but that you're literally handing him over. And in all that love and peace and beauty, I kissed my little boy on the face and I handed him over. And then came to myself or woke up back in the hospital bed to the amputation, to the colostomy bag, to the arm in a sling. I mean, I was a sight. My left leg was amputated above the knee. My right leg was in a brace, sticking straight out. My right arm was in a brace because they were trying to repair the shoulder, and all I could do was use my one left hand. But I had a little bit different perspective about things. I brought books tonight. Knowing is the personal memoir. You can certainly get one of those tonight and sign it for you. But my son, Spencer, he didn't have a near-death experience. He didn't have a mystical out-of-body thing. He didn't have anything happen to him like I did. He was 7 years old. He lost his mom, he lost his brother, and in many ways, he lost his dad too. And he had to navigate that in the innocence of a child. And he was amazing. I mean, when it was time for me to go home, and my family was amazing, my brothers were amazing. When I went home from the hospital, and they had to literally lift me into the wheelchair because I couldn't very well transport myself given all the injuries and what was going on, I had to go to my brother's house for a while because I continued home health care and everything else. But when we arrived, there was Spencer, my 7-year-old, looking out the window, watching. And he had seen me in the hospital, but he was watching as my brothers, his uncles, picked me up and put me in the wheelchair. And I kept thinking, how's he going to handle this? How do I explain this? I mean, being in the hospital bed was one thing, but now I was going to be on his turf. Like we'd have to go to the grocery store or to school. How do I explain a colostomy bag to a 7-year-old, right? Well, as I got in the chair and my brothers said, you navigate it, they build a ramp for me to get in the house. Spencer came running out the door. And he ran right toward me, but then he ran right past me, went right past. And I thought, oh, it's too much for him. He can't handle this. I just, you know, this is too much. And I begin to navigate to the ramp, and I turn to go up the ramp, but I just looked over my shoulder to see where he might be. And he actually had run across the street, and he began to knock on all the neighbors' doors, and he was shouting, "Come out, come out, come out, my dad has made it home." And he was rallying the neighbors. And as he did that, he made the loop, and I was just sitting watching, and he came back, and he then threw himself on my lap, which just about killed me, because I still had all the sutures and everything from everything that's going on. And I share this for a specific reason. He threw his arms around my neck, and he was a Star Wars nut. He still is a Star Wars nut, but I was explaining, they're going to get me a Darth Vader leg. I'm going to work really hard to get better, but I'm going to be like this for a while. And I said, "Are you going to be all right? You'll have to pitch in. You'll have to assist your old man. We got to, you know, we'll have to do this together." And we still laugh about what he said. He said, "Dad, if you were a puddle of blood, I would still love you." That's what he said. But the reason I share this is there was this moment of truth then. Here I was in a wheelchair, all busted up, and I'm holding my surviving son in my arms. And that was no less divine than being in that room holding my son in the past. Suddenly heaven was right here. There was nothing to do or become. It was simply to be in that perfect moment and feel the love of my oldest son, which was as unconditional as the love of God that I felt. And I realized, wow, maybe heaven's right here. Maybe it's up to us right now to choose how we want to live, to choose what we want to experience or how we experience it. You know, there's this crazy thing about death. Everybody's afraid of death. You know, what happens afterwards? I mean, even the IANS, you know, the international, you know, study of these things that go on, these near-death experiences. What about the life experience? You know, what about the life experience? Gosh, don't be so afraid of death that you don't live life. And also embrace the fact that we don't always get tomorrow. You know, I mean, when Tamara said, "I'm going to go kiss mom and dad one more time," I don't know if she knew that she knew, but somewhere in her soul, she knew. Tomorrow wasn't coming. So boy, do it today. You know, say those words. Tell the people you love them. Write that note, answer that text, make that phone call, go do that visit. Because time is a fragile thing. Death, time, and love. What I experienced in my near-death experience was so much love. So much love. And maybe we are love. Maybe love's everything. Maybe even the challenges we go through are love. Maybe it's a private tutorial to expand the soul so that we dig deeper, we reach farther, we love more, we love harder. And that's the point. If I brought anything back, it's like, well, there's only free will and choice. We get to choose. And the only question I was even asked was, to what degree have you learned to love? To what degree have you learned to love? Spencer, my little boy, that would love me even if I was a puddle of blood. He's now married and grown up, and he came to me a couple of years ago, and he said, "Dad, I want to write a book too." But he said, "I want to write it for the little ones. I want to write it for the kids. I want to write it for all those ones like me who didn't get the answers." You know, he said, "You had all these incredible out-of-body experiences." He said, "I beat my knuckles bloody on that door you call God in prayer, and I got nothing." And we collaborated on a little book called Where Are You? And that was his question, where are you? And it's a beautiful little book. He looked in the kitchen for his mother. He looked in the garden. He looked in the sky. She wasn't there. And everybody had the answers. Oh, she's in a better place. He said, not to me. He said, the best place for me would be have her in the garden and the kitchen. He had his own journey, and his experience was way different than mine. But he came out of it maybe better than I did. At one point, he said, maybe I'm God's hands. Maybe I'm God's light. Maybe I can do something to reach out to those kids that are struggling. And he has. He's done after school rock and roll programs and Big Brothers, Big Sisters. But he finally came to the Thank you. That's spirit speaking. He came to the conclusion that that no matter what we lose or who we lose, that they live on within us. And because we're here and we're alive, they live within us. And how we live our lives is how we honor them. I think there's a deeper message in the book, actually. We live in a world right now that maybe people are looking for the divine. Where are you? God, where are you in all this mess, right? What I learned in my near-death experience is that that lives within us too. That each and every one of us are a manifestation of the divine. And so as we search for that, maybe if we look in the mirror or look into the eyes of another person, we can say, oh, wow, there you are. There's the divine. There's God right there in you. You're a manifestation of that. And so am I. It's that namaste. The divine within me sees, recognizes, and honors the divine within you. And that's where we heal. That's where we begin to stop wars and stop the right-wrong game that we play, and we can come together in love and lock arms and say, you know what, let's just create heaven right here. No reason we can't. Anyway, I've got the books here, and I can sign them if you'd like them. I'm tired of listening to myself talk. It's coming up on 8 here. But I'd love to have questions if we have time for dialogue beyond the monologue. Does that work, Martin?
Yes.
Awesome. All right, so you can ask me anything, and I might defer it to other people. You might have questions for the doc or whatever, but ask away.
Yeah. I'd like to hear from Dr. O'Driscoll.
What do you got, doc? I'd love to hear from Dr. O'Driscoll, too.
What is it you want to hear?
What was your experience like?
Well, I knew Jeff was coming. There's always communication ahead of arrival of the patient. So I heard radio communication. I knew that his wife was deceased, that his young son was deceased and at the scene. And they don't communicate that stuff just to be morbid. They communicate that information because of something about the type of the crash and the amount of energy that was absorbed in the wreck and what kind of injuries your incoming patient may have. So I knew things were bad, and I wasn't even planning on going into the room. There was another doctor there to take care of him, but a nurse came and grabbed me by the arm and drugged me in the room, and Jeff was unconscious on the gurney. His wife, whose body was still in down near Cedar City, was standing in the air above the gurney. She filled the room with this brilliant light and love, and she communicated very clearly and without words how grateful she was for the care that he was receiving. And I walked over and I looked down at Jeff and I checked the folds in his foot because I knew he had a bad knee injury. And I remember having an understanding, a knowledge that he would lose his way at that moment. And as I looked down at him, I could still see camera standing in the air behind me because I could see in all directions at the same time. And everything in life just reorders in an instant, and all your priorities change, and you see what's important. You understand much of the same kind of experiences that Jeff described came to me in an instant as well. And it wasn't we sent Jeff to the OR, as I recall. We might have sent him to the ICU, but I think we sent him to the OR. And I took off my trauma gown and shoe covers and walked out of the room and went on with my shift, never expecting to see him again or share the experience. And I wrote, I think, one sentence in my journal that night about the experience. And then a month later, this nurse came yanking on my arm again. And she said, "We have to go tell Jeff what you experienced in the ER." Because she was the only one that knew. And she had a similar experience at the same time. She was standing next to me and she saw and experienced very much the same thing. And so she dragged me kicking and screaming up to Jeff's room because I didn't want to go. She said, "We have to come." I said, "No, we don't." She said, "No, we really do." I said, "No, no. If you want to talk to a perfect stranger about your spiritual experiences, be my guest, but I don't." But she prevailed, as nurses often do with doctors. And as I shared my experience with Jeff, which amounted to her telling the experience and me nodding,
yeah,
and not saying anything, he became emotional and took courage and shared his experience at the scene of the accident. And during that whole experience, I had this profound increasing awareness that as marvelous as the experiences we were sharing with one another that day were, that this meeting in his hospital room on that day was about our shared future together and what we would do decades down the road. And so when I showed up at Jeff's house shortly after the pool of blood arrived at home, we had a conversation that night. And I later learned that he trusted me because I showed up in cowboy boots and blue jeans wearing a Bull Rider's belt buckle. And we've been dear friends now for nearly 3 decades.
Thank you, Doc.
What was the agreement, or you know, with your wife? I mean, like, you know, what did she say, or what did you agree to? What happened there? Can you go into more detail?
Yeah, the agreement was that I would come and raise our son. That was the agreement. That was the agreement, is I would come and raise our son. And now he's raised. He's full grown. He's married. He's got a child of his own. Now he's a father. So I can go anytime. Deal's done. I can go anytime.
Well, did you have to talk? I mean, did your wife, I mean, did you want to stay? Did she have to convince you? Or was there some negotiation?
It was, there was an inner knowing that, yeah, I was coming back. But, oh, did I want to stay? I was torn. But I made a choice, and yet in my heart of hearts, I knew I was coming back, and so did she. She was emphatic about it. Yeah.
So she just encouraged that decision that you had to make.
Yeah. She kicked me out of heaven. She said, "Go, you got to go." Yeah.
Thank you.
You said something about being able to perceive the energy with people,
yeah,
in the hospital, etc. Has that persisted, or did it just fade away?
It doesn't persist every day, but it has persisted on certain occasions. I get up, I go to work, I do my thing, and I live a pretty regular life. But if I'm open to it,
so you can turn it off.
I don't know if turning it on is the right thing, if I'm open to it. For instance, I mean, I was working downtown one day. I came out of the office. There was this homeless guy that came up. He wanted money. And I was like, "Hey, look, I got to go." But then there was that whisper. And I can't emphasize that whisper. It was like, "Look at him. Just look at him." And so I did that. I looked at him. Looked him right in the eyes, and suddenly, wow, he became my brothers. He became me. I thought, but, you know, if I had not had support of my family, had I not had health insurance, that might have been me on that street corner. But then I also saw the divinity in him, just like when I was out of the body, and I began to tear up. And in fact, I just embraced him and held him. And I heard myself say to him, "I know who you are." And then he said back to me, "I know you know." And two grown men stood there on the sidewalk, shedding tears and holding each other. And he could have had all the money in my wallet, and yet he no longer wanted anything but to be acknowledged. So these little wrinkles, you know, I think we can all perceive energy. I think we really can. I think if we're open to it, you'll feel something. You might be walking down the road, or you might be going somewhere and say, oh, stay away from that. Don't go in there. Or, boy, embrace them. Go talk to them. I call it instincts. We live where we see the deer and the birds and the, you know, the raccoons and a lot of wildlife. And I tell my sons, trust your instincts. Trust your instincts. We all have them. And the animals have instincts. The birds know where to go and where to be. And it's really funny to watch them fly off. And all of a sudden there's a cat, you know, they just know. And we know if we trust it, we just know what we know. And I think that's that intuitive energy. So I don't believe it's a gift that's unique to any individual. I think it's a gift that's unique, but universal to all of us if we're open to it. It's a good question, though. Thank you.
Last time you spoke here, you talked about your wife weighing in on where she was going to be married. Will you talk about that? And then there was also, I can't remember the details, but something about if you were going to kiss her or not. I think it was after you met your second wife.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's
those two things.
I'll talk about those really briefly just for time's sake. Yeah. While I was in the hospital and unconscious and ventilated and on and on and on, the family was having not an argument, but some turmoil about where do they bury Tamara and Griffin? Where should they be buried? Now, her family had burial plots down in southern Utah, and they thought they should go down there. At the time, nobody knew if I was going to make it or not. And my family's like, well, I don't know if we should bury Jeff clear down in southern Utah. And what about Spencer? Should he be where? I didn't know any of that. In my unconscious state, and granted, I was on a lot of morphine, but I had a dream vision where Tamara came to me and she began to tell me what she wanted. You know, she wanted her cousin to have that special ring. And she wanted her sister-in-laws to have those fancy dresses, almost trivial. But she wanted to be buried with the baby in her arms, in Bountiful, so Spencer and I could be close. I didn't know the family had any turmoil. And this is a crazy thing. They transferred me to a different hospital. I'd been life flighted into a hospital that was not in my insurance network. And so they like to transfer me from LDS to the U hospital. And in doing so, they took the ventilator out briefly. And I was conscious for that. That's not fun. Have a ventilator taken out of you when you're conscious. It's not fun. I was able to share briefly with key people in the room, my brother, Tamara's mom and dad, that she had come to me and she'd shared these wishes. And they're like, that's the answer. That's what we've been fighting about. That's what we've been in turmoil over. And so that came through, and that's exactly what happened. It was a point in my life, the second question you asked, where I was really in turmoil. I mean, I had had some rough things happen. This is after the accident. I had remarried. There was some rough things, some choices. And I was really in a bad state. And that was a dream while I was sleeping. I went to sleep. And in this dream, Tamara, I call her my angelic wife. She's not deceased. She's very much alive and well. She came dancing up to me in this dream. And she put her arms around my neck and she danced around me. And then she kissed me on the cheek, which I thought, well, what's all that about? You know, let's lay one on me. But perhaps she was respecting the fact that I was in a different situation now, another marriage. But in that dream, what she communicated to me is it doesn't matter what you did or what you didn't do. What matters is what you're learning. She said, all that exists here is wisdom. That's all there is wisdom. So life isn't a test, it's a gift. We're simply here to learn. And she was just sharing that with me in a moment that I really deserve to have that information. But that's what you're referring to. So thank you. It's all in the book. It's all in the book if you want to read it. Yeah. Was that a plug? Was that a plug?
Thank you. This is amazing.
Thank you
very much for sharing.
Thank you.
It almost seemed as though you had two experiences, the one at the synagogue, and then later on, how much time you asked between that and we had and saw your past.
Yeah, it was months between
the two. So yeah. was that just a sort of more of a dream? Or, I mean, obviously, it wasn't a dream. You were physically there. I'm just trying to grasp whether could you also could pass over a second time or.
It felt very much the same. No, I was never pronounced. And she was just sharing that with me in a moment that I really deserve to have that information. But that's what you're referring to. So thank you. It's all in the book. It's all in the book if you want to read it. Yeah.